Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct the question and answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Andrea, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop. And today's program is, the topic is treatment update for adults living with acute lymphocytic leukemia, or ALL. And today's program is one that's a really important program. Many of you are living with ALL and really and want to know more about its treatment and really how to cope with it. So today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, as well as blood cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in the program today that we've been able to reach so many of you. Now, we have on the program today over 526 participants, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, Serbia, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So this is really a global call. And although you can't see all 526 of each other, you're all there. And so for those of you who might be feeling like, oh, you know, there's no one else who's dealing with this or trying to figure this out, there's lots of people on the call, much like yourself, wanting to know information about this really important topic and in terms of how and the newest treatments. Now, today's program was supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen, Ariad Pharmaceuticals, Inc., and Pfizer. And I really want to thank them for their support of today's program and also their corporate partnership and support in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Raul Tibbis, and Dr. Tibbis is consultant, actually global consultant, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Acute and Chronic Leukemia Program, Scholar in Clinical Research, Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, Assistant Professor, Mayo College of Medicine, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center. And Dr. Tibbis is going to address an overview of acute lymphocytic leukemia, acute lymphocytic lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and targeted therapy, and the important role of clinical trials. Now, it's my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Tibbis.
Yeah, thank you very much, Carolyn. And you actually mentioned the first thing. The most commonly used term is probably acute lymphoblastic or acute lymphoid leukemia. But lymphocytic, it's a little different cell form. But I think often, you know, patients may hear the different terms. So the question I often get when I'm in front of patients is, what is leukemia? And then what is acute lymphocytic leukemia? So what acute leukemia is essentially an abnormal and quick growth, cell growth of white cells. And all of our white cells are white blood cells. They're produced in the bone marrow. And in ALL, that's essentially the lymphocytic or the lymphoid lineage. So everybody, we have white cells that are in our bloodstream, and white cells are produced in the bone marrow. And there are two big groups of white cells, the lymphoid and the myeloid. And today we'll talk about the lymphoid leukemias, which is ALL. So at some point, and we don't quite understand all the reasons why or the causes why, a few white cells decide to grow faster and essentially become leukemia cells. When they grow faster, they push away the other cells in the bone marrow. Those are the red cells that carry the oxygen and the platelets that help us clot. So the lymphoid white cells take over the bone marrow, grow quicker, and as a result, patients become anemic, patients have low platelets, and are at risk of bleeding, risk of infections. And the lymphoid cells, or the ALL cells, they're not functioning as good as normal cells. They're immature. That's also important to understand the disease. So those are immature cells that have arrested on a very early, like, embryonic level, so to say, in terms of a white cell. And patients can often present, they're tired, they can have bone pain, they can have infections, they can have bleedings, and then a CBC is done, a blood test is done, and then patients can have low blood counts and often have high high white blood cell count. And then various tests are done that tell the physician this is the potential or it could be a leukemia, an acute leukemia. And then by various tests we have developed over the last decades, we can narrow it down. We can narrow it down to an acute lymphoid or lymphoblastic leukemia, ALL. The next steps are then, obviously, if it's an acute leukemia, patients are admitted to the hospital, and then a bone marrow biopsy is done. Because all the blood cells and all what we see in the blood is produced in the bone marrow. So the bone marrow is the fabric, is the source. So that's why we all always go to the bone marrow to know actually what's happening as a better reflection of the disease. So from a bone marrow biopsy, but also from a blood test, additional tests can be sent off, and I think that's important, and you can ask your physician that if you don't know, or you can look on your reports or of friends, or if you see those reports. We send what we call cytogenetic markers or chromosome studies. That's sometimes more easy to remember. So every cell has chromosomes, and we can measure if the chromosomes are abnormal in those leukemia cells. And why is that important? Because it helps us to risk stratify the leukemia. So based if there are abnormalities of the chromosomes and some and other genes within those leukemia cells, physicians can risk stratify the leukemia and can further characterize the molecular features of the ALL and then initiate an appropriate treatment. I think it's very important. And I often stress here to my patients that it's actually you, the patient, is not abnormal. It's truly just the white cells, the ALL cells, that have acquired the ability to grow faster. So the rest of the body cells, your hair cells, your brain cells, they're all normal. It's usually not a genetic disease. It's not contagious. And it's also usually, most of the time, not inherited. So once we have a diagnosis of an ALL, physicians need to start treatment on a rather urgent basis. So there's not a time to send the patient home. So usually we admit the patient, do the workup, the diagnostic workup, know the risk group, and that helps us in the molecular features of the ALL, and that helps us decide which treatment. So as part of the current standard of care treatment and the treatment, I think one can distinguish two big groups. One, it's the so-called Philadelphia chromosome positive ALL. The Philadelphia chromosomes essentially was described in Philadelphia, as the name says, but that's essentially where two chromosomes are just now closer to each other and flipped close to each other. And there are certain genes on those two chromosomes, they are now brought together and in a way just open up the way for those ALL cells to grow. So Philadelphia chromosome positive leukemia, and the gene that is sitting on those two chromosomes, it's called the BCR-ABL gene. That's important because now already 15 or 20 years, we have developed so-called BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase inhibitor. The most prominent examples are imatinib or Gleevec in the U.S. There's nilotinib or dasatinib and several other ones. So the first distinguishing for treatment is this a Philadelphia chromosome positive ALL or negative? If it's a positive ALL, we usually, if the patient is younger or can tolerate therapy or more intensive therapy, the physician would start any kind of a chemotherapy regimen and would add one of those very specific BCR-ABL tyrosine inhibitors. Those are all medications that are added to the chemotherapy. The chances of achieving a remission are quite high for those patients. And unfortunately, even a remission is the absence of any measurable leukemia. So after the first month or the second month, we want to achieve a complete remission. So physicians repeat a bone marrow biopsy after the first month, and then they see, well, there's no leukemia cell left, that is good. And in addition, we also want the normal blood cells to recover. So essentially wiping out the leukemia from the bone marrow with the recovery of the normal blood cells. And then, unfortunately, in the Philadelphia chromosome-positive ALL, there are often relapses, meaning despite treatment and continued treatment, the leukemia can come back. So for patients that qualify, meaning they are young enough, fit enough, don't have too many other illnesses and diseases, have the social support system, most of the time a stem cell transplantation or a bone marrow transplantation is recommended. So stem cell and bone marrow, those terms are used interchangeably because the stem cells, they live in the bone marrow. And importantly, those are cells from a donor, so from somebody else given to the patient. So an allogeneic stem cell transplantation is recommended if the patient can tolerate it. For Philadelphia chromosome positive patients that are older, 75, 80, or sometimes even mid to high 60s, there are also therapies that include steroids and just those oral medications, and those also can be very effective. So it doesn't always have to be the intensive chemotherapy plus those oral drugs. It can also be more like lower intensive therapy with an oral drug, and it can be quite helpful. For the other big group, the Philadelphia chromosome negative ALL, we distinguish often and we think about the disease. We do the same workup. We do all the analysis on the bone marrow, the molecular structures, the risk stratification, so the risk markers that helps us to decide how likely it is that the leukemia will go into a remission, as well as how likely it is to come back. So for the PH negative, so Philadelphia chromosome negative ALL, we distinguish between younger adults up to the age of 40, some would say 45, and older adults. Why is this important? Because the younger adults, so below the age of 40 generally, they're able to tolerate more intensive chemotherapies, and those therapies should be given to those younger patients. The older patients, and that could be in many of the studies, it was 40 years, sometimes in clinical practice, we push the limits to 45 or 50. In older patients above those ages, we still give them an intensive chemotherapy, but maybe not quite as intensive. So similar to the other leukemias, we treat the patient for a month, and then we want to know if the leukemia has gone or is gone. Then we repeat a bone marrow biopsy. But I think what's also important to mention here and to note, and patients could ask their physician, is what we call the minimal residual disease, or MRD. So minimal, so little few cells left, residual disease. There are several ways to measure that, but it's important. Those tests are essentially very sensitive tests that on a molecular basis, and with a very high sensitivity, can detect if there are any cells left. And sometimes compared to a telescope, if you just have a binocular, you can see. But if you really have a big telescope, you see much clearer and much more in detail. So those MRD tests, I think, are important because they can also help us decide if a patient has a chance of potentially being cured with chemotherapy versus if a patient should be recommended for an allogeneic stem cell or an allogeneic bone marrow transplantation. And I think that those are the broad or the big picture for the current standard of care. So important to note that younger patients may be able to tolerate more intensive therapy and thus have a higher chance of being cured actually with chemotherapy. And if it's a bad disease or if there's some disease left after 1 or 2 months of treatment that we can measure with those MRD tests, a transplant should also be considered as a general rule. The other question is then, what do we do if a patient relapses or if the leukemia has come back, either if it never really responded, never went away completely, or after a year or a few years, the leukemia may come back? Well, then one could repeat different chemotherapies again, and physicians or we are able to achieve another remission, meaning another absence of leukemia. But again, a transplant then would be recommended once the leukemia had relapsed or is refractory, meaning it didn't respond. So since chemotherapies are good but not good enough, over the last couple of years, a couple of new therapies have been developed. And maybe we can group them into oral medications, inhibitors, kinase inhibitors, that similar to imatinib or nilotinib or dasatinib. Unfortunately, there's no such inhibitor for the pH negative leukemias. Unless the BCR ABL or pH positive leukemias, we don't have this one drug that really makes a big difference. Therefore, a lot of antibodies have been developed. Antibodies are proteins that go and block proteins, other proteins on the leukemia cells. And I think a couple of notable of the antibodies are, for example, inotuzumab, which is an antibody drug conjugate. So essentially, scientists were able to put a chemotherapy drug to an antibody, which is a protein, and now it's very specific, like going and this antibody, inotuzumab, or other ones are out there as well, like blinatumomab, which I will talk to in a second. So those antibodies find the leukemia cells, and the leukemia cells take up this antibody, get the chemotherapy inside them, and then they're starting to die, like a Trojan horse, so to speak. Another great development of the last couple of years, and I think it's very important because the drug was recently approved, and Dr. Lidso is taking a very active role in the development of this drug. It's called blinatumomab. So what is that? So similar, it's an antibody, but that antibody has another part to it, has two parts, so to speak. The one part of the antibody is able to recognize the leukemia cell, and the other part is able to attract immune cells. So the body's own immune cells, and brings those cells close to the leukemia cells. And now the body's immune cells can recognize the leukemia cells and can start killing the leukemia cells. So it's called blinatumomab. And it's a drug that was approved in the United States in the last year or so, or maybe even longer now, for the different indications. And this drug can really work quite well in patients where the leukemia has not responded or where the leukemia has come back despite chemotherapy. And now Dr. Lidso is involved in testing this medication in the first line setting, meaning incorporating it from the get-go, from the beginning, into the treatment of leukemia. And then the last new therapy I want to highlight and stress on is the so-called CAR T cells. Question probably will also come from the audience. So that's essentially another way where scientists were able to take out T cells or immune cells from the patient. They're able to grow them outside in the laboratory under very sterile conditions, and they're able to be given back to the patient, and then modify them. So those cells are then given back to the patient, so it's the patient's own immune cells that are modified outside the body, and then they're given back to the patient. And then what they do, they can recognize again the leukemia cells, and now they have kind of an activator inside them that then starts firing and destroying the leukemia cells. So it's an immune-based cell therapy, again, harnessing an immune response against the leukemia cells. None of those this CAR T cells, they're not yet approved, but there are many trials throughout the country and the world offering those for patients if other therapies have not worked. And this brings me to the last point, the importance of clinical trials. Like with any other cancer, ALL and acute leukemias, we can only improve our therapy if we learn or can demonstrate that the new therapies are truly better than what we have. So in order to do that and to offer patients a chance to be treated with a new therapy that is based and developed on the best science we have, we encourage patients to participate in clinical trials. And a good clinical trial, the question I often get is, will I get a placebo? Meaning, will I get like a sugar water, or will I just get some? Will I get the active medication, the drug itself, or will I get placebo? Yes, there are trials where a patient is getting placebo, meaning and not the actual drug, but many trials and many clinical trials actually, particularly in cancer, do give patients a medication that potentially can be active and can work against the leukemia. So we generally encourage patients to participate in trials, and especially for diseases like ALL, which are still rare, there are not that many standard treatment options, and we have to learn together with our patients, and that's one reason why we have clinical trials, because those are new medications developed on science, and we We have to give them under very well-controlled circumstances and an experienced center so that the patient is safe and we can see if those medications work, and we can give patients the treatment options where otherwise all other therapies have failed before. With that, I want to close and give it back to you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Tibbetts. That was really outstanding and really wonderful and such important information for everybody to have on the call in terms of helping to cope with, you know, with ALL. That information, we see that as a very powerful tool in coping with and understanding ALL and all of its treatments. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Mark Litzo. And Dr. Litzo is Professor of Medicine, Chair ECOG, ACRIN Leukemia Committee, Chair Myeloid Disease Group, Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Litzo is going to address therapy for relapsed refractory ALL, practical tips to manage complications and side effects, quality of life concerns, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Litzo.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. And just tell me how much time I have so that I don't go... Should take 10 minutes or so, or a little less than that?
More than that.
Okay.
About 15 minutes is fine. Whatever time you need. You have such important topics, definitely.
Yes, well, thank you. So Dr. Tibbetts spoke about the initial treatment of patients that have the Philadelphia chromosome as part of their acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and then patients who do not have that. And in younger patients, he indicated that using more intensive treatments like are used in children, in pediatrics, can be curative so that the leukemia does not return. We use similar approaches, but less intense in older individuals, and in those patients, sometimes they can be cured, but unfortunately not as frequently as in younger people. The Philadelphia negative and Philadelphia chromosome positive ALLs are both what we call B cell. They arise from normal young lymphocytes that, again, are called B cells. And B stands for Bursa fabricius, and it's an organ in chickens. And this is where the B cells were first identified and discovered. The other type of, those are the B cell ALL. And the other type of ALL is the T cell ALL. And T cell stands for thymus. T-H-Y-M-U-S. And this is an organ in the middle of our chest that participates in the maturation and growth of the T-cells. So our goal with our initial treatment always is to try to cure patients. And sometimes, as Dr. Tibbetts said, we need to incorporate a stem cell or bone marrow transplant as part of that initial treatment, but unfortunately, despite all these efforts, the leukemia can relapse or return. And there are subsets, unfortunately, relatively small numbers of patients where the leukemia doesn't respond well to the initial treatment, and we call that refractory, meaning that the initial treatment has not worked. So what do we do for patients where the leukemia comes back or it's refractory? We can use alternate chemotherapy drugs, and this is something that we have done for many years. So there are alternate, or we call them salvage regimens, that we use to see if they will be effective, because sometimes leukemia cells, as cancer cells, are resistant to one drug that works one way but can be sensitive to another drug that works another way. So we'll try alternate forms or sometimes alternate schedules or doses of chemotherapy to see if they will work. In the B cell ALL, Dr. Tibbetts mentioned several new what we call monoclonal antibody constructs. These are these proteins that are called antibodies, and our body normally makes antibodies to help us fight infection, but we can scientists have learned to produce antibodies in the laboratory that can react against cells. So Dr. Tibbetts mentioned inotuzumab, which is linked to a chemotherapy drug that binds to a protein on the B leukemia cell and can bring the chemotherapy right to the cell and kill it. And inotuzumab has been shown to be more effective than chemotherapy for patients with relapse acute leukemia, and it's likely going to be approved by the Food and Drug Administration perhaps later this year or early next year for treatment. He also mentioned blinatumomab, which is also an antibody construct, and it brings a normal T cell, not a leukemic T cell, but a normal T cell or T lymphocyte in close proximity to the leukemia cell, so that that T cell can kill the leukemia cell. So that's a form of immune therapy. There are also other new drugs that have been approved for ALL. There's one called Markebo, which is taking an old drug we've used for many years, vincristine, and putting it in a different form so that it becomes more potent or more effective. It doesn't have as high a response rate as we would like, but it is well tolerated and it can sometimes be effective. Dr. Tibbetts also mentioned the CAR T cells, where we actually take one of these antibodies and put it in a normal T cell and again use the power of the immune system or this normal T cell to kill the leukemia cells. If we can get a patient into remission if they've relapsed or have refractory disease, and if they've not had a bone marrow transplant, then we will definitely consider one at that time. Sometimes if someone's had a bone marrow transplant and the leukemia comes back afterwards, we can do a second transplant. That is a finer line to determine when and if that is appropriate. We can also sometimes get additional immune cells from the donor that the patient used and give those as an immune boost to try to help bring the leukemia back under control. That's called a donor lymphocyte infusion. So that's sometimes also considered. Usually patients have to get chemotherapy or some other form of treatment, such as blinatumomab, to get their leukemia back under control, hopefully back into a remission, and then we can consider the donor lymphocyte infusion or a second transplant at that time. Because even if they've gone back into remission after a relapse, we know that without another transplant or this lymphocyte boost, it's not likely that we're going to be able to keep a person in remission long-term. The other thing is the genetic revolution and our understanding of the molecules and the genes that are important in the development of leukemia. We've been able to identify more and more of those. And there is a subtype of the Philadelphia negative acute leukemia that shares characteristics, or when we do the molecular testing, looks like they could have Philadelphia positive ALL, but they don't because they don't have the Philadelphia chromosome. But they have certain features that make it look like that. So we call that Philadelphia-like. And these patients can have certain genetic abnormalities that can be sensitive to other drugs that we have available. And in fact, sometimes like the tyrosine kinase inhibitor that Dr. Tibbetts mentioned, like imatinib or dasatinib, their leukemia can be sensitive to those drugs, again, even though they don't have the classic Philadelphia chromosome. Are there some other subtypes of this Philadelphia-like where there are drugs that we have available that were developed for other diseases but now have been shown to be helpful in this setting? So we have many more opportunities than we used to treat relapse and refractory disease. We've lagged a bit behind in developing newer therapies for the T-cell type of ALL. That's been a harder nut for us to crack, so to speak. There's a gene abnormality that's seen frequently in T-cell ALL called NOTCH, or the NOTCH inhibitor. NOTCH, N-O-T-C-H, and we have drugs that are NOTCH inhibitors that are being tested. But they're still in fairly early stages of development, and we're not sure exactly what role they're going to play. For T-cell ALL, there is a chemotherapy drug that can be effective called nalirabine, and this is another option that we sometimes use to treat those patients. So just in my last minute or two, practical tips for managing complications and side effects, that could be a whole topic in itself. But just to touch on a few highlights, chemotherapy, as we've mentioned, is the backbone in most instances for the treatment of ALL. And so that can affect a person's gastrointestinal tract with nausea, vomiting, loss of appetite, sometimes diarrhea. There's a whole host of medications that we have to help lessen the severity of those side effects, sometimes eliminate them, and we try to maximize our use of those for treatment. I constantly encourage my patients to exercise, and they don't have to run the mile, but I encourage them to be up and walking and moving every day, riding a stationary bike. I think it's just critical for them to keep up some level of exercise to the extent that they can do it to counteract the fatigue and keep their strength up to get through these treatments. We sometimes use preventive or prophylactic antibiotics to lessen the risk of infection. The vincristine drug that I mentioned, which is, I mentioned that new form of it, but we also use the old standby vincristine as a one of the backbones of treatment of ALL, and that can cause nerve damage. So many of you may have experienced neuropathy, numbness, tingling, and pain in your fingers or particularly in the feet. And there's a host of medications that we can use to minimize that. There's other stimulatory treatments. There's something that we use here at Mayo called Scrambler, S-C-R-A-M-B-L-E-R, that has been found to be helpful. I'm honestly not sure how widely used that is. Also, complementary and alternative medicine approaches can be considered, but one has to be cautious in this area because some of the complementary and alternative medicines can have their own side effects. They can affect the liver, for example. So if you are advised or think you want to try some of those things, many, many hospitals now have we here at Mayo have a complementary medicine group. We have our patients see them. Our pharmacists will review some of those approaches and make sure that they're not going to counteract the effects of the chemotherapy or other drugs that we're using for ALL. So these are a lot of things that can be done to help improve your quality of life and try to bring some normalcy to your life as you're going through this treatment. And finally, I would encourage you to be proactive in your care, to ask questions, to be an active participant. I think of my patients and myself and our nurses and chaplains and social workers and dietitians. We're a team. We're all working together to maximize your health, and you're a key member of that team. So don't be hesitant to ask questions, to say, well, what about this? What about that? To perhaps even look at getting a second opinion. I think if a doctor is offended if someone wants to get a second opinion, I don't think very as highly of a doctor like that, because I never hesitate to let my patients get a second opinion. More heads th- thinking about your situation are always helpful. So don't be a wallflower, but advocate for yourself and ask questions. With that, I'll stop.
I'd like to thank you so much, Dr. Lissa. That was really outstanding. And I really, that whole message to people about really, you know, do ask your physician questions, and you are such a central part of the healthcare team. And the healthcare team includes so many different specialties that Dr. Lissa has identified. And those are people all who can offer different aspects to you for help and with all the different issues that you may be confronting. So definitely take advantage of that healthcare team. And our next speaker, Sarah Kelly, is an oncology social worker, and she is another oncology social workers are a part of those healthcare teams. And she is our older adult program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Kelly is going to address the Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services. As a way of identifying for all of you all the psychosocial help that's out there for you, help with emotional and social and practical issues. And she's also going to talk about the role of support groups that many people find invaluable. So I'm now going to turn this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As Dr. Messner said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people diagnosed with ALL and their loved ones. We've really been talking today about managing your care, at the end of the day, quality of life issues, and I'd like to speak about the importance of creating a support network as part of that care and how Cancer Care can be a part of your network. So just a little about us. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We do that face-to-face in the New York area. We do it over the phone nationally. We have support groups, which we also provide face-to-face in New York, over the phone nationally, and online nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one we're on today. We provide practical help. We can help you navigate all the systems you're dealing with, and we also provide some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and as I said before, they're completely free of charge. Oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, so really how a diagnosis affects the whole support network. We're also trained to help cancer patients and their supports tackle the issues that accompany the disease, financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact in care. And I find adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis in all of the areas I mentioned is an important part of the healing process, and I actually consider it to be an part of treatment itself. As you know, cancer really does affect the whole person, the entire support network, and no matter where you are on the trajectory of your journey, there may be times where you need additional support. Asking for help, joining a support group, contacting a social worker for counseling is so important and can be really a huge help to you as you're going through this. One of the things I'd like for you to take with you is that you don't have to do this on your own. You don't have to do it alone. I think Dr. Lissa really spoke to this when he talked about being proactive, asking questions, really knowing that you are a key member of the team. Part of that is reaching out and letting people know what you need. With individual counseling, you have a space that's yours to voice any of the concerns or navigate any of the issues I mentioned earlier. And with a support group, you're really with folks who also know what you're going through. They understand it because they're going through a similar experience. Feeling well emotionally, I just find it helps you better deal with the diagnosis and with all of the things that accompany that. I'm going to talk a little bit now just about the specific services. At this time, we are providing an online support group for anyone who is diagnosed with blood cancers. So if you're looking to connect with others who have ALL, that is a wonderful opportunity. We also currently have both patient and caregiver groups face-to-face in the New York area, on the phone nationally, and we also provide those groups online, as I said earlier, nationally and internationally. If you are interested in any of these services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE. That's 1-800-813-4673. I also encourage you to visit our website, which is www.cancercare.org. We have a very comprehensive website, so you'll find a lot of information not only on support, but also on all the programs, as well as on your diagnosis, treatment, and just ways of coping as you go through this. Today's program had a lot of information. It's a lot to digest and get your arms around. Just know that we're here to help you understand what it means for you and for your loved ones. If you have any questions about today's workshop or about our services, don't hesitate to contact us. And lastly, I really do want to stress and say again that you're not alone going through this. Really, you know, there are people there to be with you. We're here with you, and our services are here to help you. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Kelly. That was really outstanding and just a wonderful review of many of the emotional and social and practical services that are really very important in your coping with ALL and coping with cancer. So thank you. And now I want to thank all of our speakers, because now we have time for questions. And I'm going to ask Andrea to bring all of our speakers on board and also to explain to you how to queue up for questions. This is a great opportunity during this part of the program for you to ask questions. I know sometimes many of you will use this as a practice run for questions you might like to ask your physicians or would like to just hear from our speakers. Of course, our speakers can't give you an absolute consult, but they can really give you some very key things to consider, for everybody to consider around the issues that you may raise in a general way. So I really do invite you to kind of ask away, and we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question at the end of the call, I'll tell you exactly how to get any other questions that are left at the end of the program answered. So I'm going to ask Andrea to go ahead and explain to all of you how to queue up the questions, and we'll let the questions begin.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then the number one key on your touch tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star, then one.
And so we have a question from one of our online participants, from Jonas. How can someone get a second opinion for ALL? Should I ask my current doctor for a referral, or should I try to find one on my own? So Dr. Lutzow, could you address that question, please, and just in a general way in terms of just the whole process of getting a second opinion?
Well, I think you can do either one. I think you can ask your doctor to say, that I appreciate your opinion and your treatment plan sounds reasonable to me. But before we embark on this, again, if you have time, and it's going to depend on, where you're at in your treatment, because as Dr. Tibbis mentioned, we often have to start treatment very quickly when we first diagnose ALL. Because it is a medical urgency or emergency, so there may not always be time to, wait a week and go somewhere else and get another opinion. But depending on the timing, I think you can ask your doctor. You also can, go online, and there's, reputable sources such as Cancer Care, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, has a great patient advocacy group, a lot of patient information. They could help you find other centers where there are ALL experts that you could go and see. So I think either way can really work to, get a second opinion. Was there a second part of that question also, or?
So the question was, should I try to find one on my own? Sort of like, should I try to get a second opinion on my own as opposed to working with my doctor?
Yeah, so that was the point I made, that either way can work. And if you need help finding, if you do end up doing it on your own, then there are these resources available to help you identify other hospitals and centers where you might go.
And those are excellent points. Of course, there is a Leukemia Lymphoma Society, which is a wonderful resource and has a call center. You certainly can call our staff here for help with just getting referred. There's the National Cancer Institute website, www.clinicaltrials.gov. You'll be getting actually a summary of all of this at the end of the call as well. But there are a number of wonderful blood cancer organizations out there that actually have tremendous information as well for you, and they're listed actually in the program brochure, and they're also will be sent to you, of course, as a follow-up to this call today. But I think this is really important to know. There is so much, there's information out there, and it often is, well, it can be challenging to focus it. I wonder, Sarah, if you want to say something about that in terms of just, there are probably close to 10 organizations that one could go to, and there is, of course, some repetition, so that's the good thing, if you do look for consistency in terms of that. But do you want to comment on that, just that effort to go out there?
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you're looking to do it on your own, going to somewhere that you know has, and when I say somewhere, an organization that could refer you that has a good reputation. So I would avoid things like message boards. I think you could definitely call the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, National Cancer Institute, places like that that can really give you some good information. I also think it's good if you feel comfortable having a conversation with your doctor about it. I know Dr. Litzau talked about this when he was speaking earlier, but having it be collaborative. So letting your doctor know, listen, I'm interested in getting another opinion, whether you find someone on your own or your doctor helps you or gets you connected to someone else, I think having it being a collaborative process does make it a little bit easier and keeps that line of communication open.
Thank you. And a question actually for Dr. Tivis. Should I consider a clinical trial for ALL versus other types of leukemia? So is that something that one should really consider participating in a clinical trial, and then how does one go about doing that? If you could just say a bit more about that.
Well, I think that is, it always depends on the trial, obviously. I think I can't give you a general rule that, you know, are ALL trials more worthwhile participating than other cancers or other cancers than in ALL. I think we're making discoveries, fortunately, and there's an advancement, an improvement in the science that rather quickly comes to clinical application. And as a general rule, I would also talk to my physician or ask him, is there any new development? There may not be, and the standard therapy may still be the best, and you don't want to compromise the standard therapy. I think that's a general rule to say. You don't want to compromise the standard therapy. If the standard therapy is not that good and you have the first information or clinical, you know, information that adding a drug to standard therapy is good or much better, then I would try to get this at the patient. It's difficult for a patient to know if something is better. That's, it's important that the doctors, you know, keep up their education, but I think it's the right of the patient to ask the doctor, hey, this is the standard. You told me about those two options. Is there a clinical trial you know of? So I think it's a fair and valid question that, you know, the patient can ask their doctor. And it can change quickly. So if there's not a trial now, in 6 months, all of a sudden we can have a new medication where all of a sudden it shows some promise or some good initial clinical data. So it's worthwhile to also circle back to your doctor and ask your doctor. So I think as a general rule, I think there's no general rule, but I think considering a trial or asking or keeping an open mind with that, that's important. And, you know, maybe for the patients on clinical trials actually don't do worse. They actually do better, and often they do get much more attention to their care. And even in early clinical trials, so the very early ones where medication is given for, you know, to the first couple of dozens and hundreds of patients, it's generally safe. So there are big studies with thousands of patients where patients who are participating in the trial do not have a worse outcome or do not suffer much more, actually. So it's safe for most patients as long as the good clinical practices and rules are followed.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Excellent. And we have a question from one of our telephone participants. Andrea?
Yeah, Yes, our first question comes from the line of Susan M. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for giving us your time, doctors. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. My sister is ALL Philadelphia positive, diagnosed in 2012, and her BCR / AABL test results have been, I'll use the word, bumpy. She's not getting a 0.00, and she has now been put on panatinib.
Mm-hmm.
Am I saying that right?
Panatinib, yes. Very good.
Okay. And I know we're running out of silver bullets here, and her doctor mentioned a therapy called BiTE. How are you familiar with that one? It's an immune therapy.
And was that your question, Susan? Did you have
that? That is my question. Yes.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Well, thank you for actually that wonderful question. And I'm going to ask all of our speakers to address that. I'm going to ask Dr. Tadis to go first with that. And your sister is so fortunate to have you as a sister, because here you are on the call and really trying to get information, which is really what more could one ask for in terms of that care. So, Dr. Tadis, if you could address this in a general way. And then, of course, Susan will suggest that you take all of this back to your sister her doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
In a general way, so this Philadelphia chromosome, that BCR-ABL is the gene that sits on those two chromosomes. What we do in clinical practice and routine, we do measure from the bone marrow, but also now from the peripheral blood, so blood test is good enough. We measure this BCR-ABL, and with very fine, very sensitive detection methods. So we do ideally want to see it go away or almost to undetectable level, meaning we can't, our assays can barely see it any longer. So a molecular response, that's the goal. So to answer your question is how bumpy it is. If she's still in a major molecular response, you know, there may be some fluctuation. If she's truly never achieved a major molecular response, and you can ask her that, and I think you mentioned those terms, and if she is truly coming up on several occasions above this threshold level of achieving a major molecular response, and that repeats itself 2-3 times, I think then it's time to change. What's important is there are mutations. So this BCR-ABL gene can develop mutations. It can change itself. So it doesn't respond so well to this first BCR-ABL tyrosine inhibitor anymore. But then physicians do a mutation test, and maybe one of the other 2-3 drugs that are approved can work. So that's one option. But not every patient with a BCR-ABL positive or Philadelphia positive, BCR-ABL positive leukemia has mutations if they don't respond. So first mutation testing, and that can help you narrow it down. This ponatinib is a very good drug that often works when the other BCR-ABL tyrosine inhibitors do not work. Ponatinib has side effects, mostly cardiovascular, as can the other ones, the other inhibitors have as well. But ponatinib has a little more side effects. So your sister, if she's on ponatinib, as a practical advice, pressure should be controlled. She shouldn't smoke. So any cardiovascular risk factor should be well controlled or as good as possible. The lipids and the cholesterol and everything should be looked at. But your doctor should know that. Then blinatumomab, I think you mentioned that, or the BiTE, that's a medication which both Dr. Litzo and I mentioned earlier. This is this bispecific antibody, which is an antibody that recognizes proteins on the leukemia cells and brings an immune cell, T cell, close to those leukemia cells. And now the immune cells can recognize and start firing and try to destroy this leukemia cell. Initially, these were developed for the pH-negative leukemia, but it has been shown they also can work quite nicely against the pH-positive leukemias. I would reserve that if your sister truly has a relapse, a more fulminant relapse, and the other options with those tyrosine kinase inhibitors have been exhausted. And if she's young enough and fit enough, and depending how bumpy, if it's truly coming up, then a transplant should also be discussed if she's younger. If she's 80 or above 75 or even above 65, 70, I mean, we can argue about the age. It may be difficult. Lastly, and then I finish, adherence is very important. So those oral medications, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, they really need to be taken every day, and dosages shouldn't be skipped. And some of the medications, you need to take them 2 hours before food, and you can't eat an hour or 2 hours after. So there can also be a problem with absorption. So double-check all of those things with her. Mark, if you want to pitch in.
Thank you, Dr. Lipsa. Do you want to add, because it's really a very wonderful question.
Yes, well, just to elaborate, so BITE, B-I-T-E, stands for bispecific T-cell engaging, then antibody. And so blinatumomab is an example of, and it's the first example, the first one that was developed as a, of a bispecific T-cell engaging antibody. And there are other ones that are in development that can be used for other types of leukemia and hematologic malignancies. So BITE is a class of these antibodies or treatment that that we can use. You know, otherwise, I would agree with Dr. Tibbetts and what he said, but there are studies that have shown that blinatumomab is effective for the Philadelphia chromosome positive ALL. So if these other things that Dr. Tibbetts mentioned have been done, and these other tyrosine kinase inhibitors don't look like they're going to be helpful, then certainly blinatumomab can be very helpful in this setting.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Susan, because you are what we call a caregiver, and I'm going to ask Sarah Kelly to say a few words about the important role of caregivers and just, I think, your questions and the knowledge that you've yourself have about your sister's, ALL, and the fact that you're able to ask really such an informed question really demonstrates how important caregivers are. And so if you would like to say something, Sarah, about just the role of caregivers and that they're entitled to get some support too, actually.
Absolutely. So first I just want to say you sound like an amazing support to your sister. Just even being on the call, all the things you learn, I mean, you have, it sounds like, a lot of knowledge about her particular case and the ins and outs of the diagnosis itself in treatment. And that can be huge for the patient to know that they have someone there who's really walking with them. It also really highlights what happens for caregivers. Often the caregiver does have this knowledge. They are in many ways going through this with the patient. And so with that, I don't know if you've spoken with other caregivers, but often a lot of the same different issues come up. The same way a patient goes through this emotionally, a caregiver also goes through it emotionally. So, you know, I just want to stress that as you're there walking with her in this, that you at different points may feel like you'd like more support, and we're here for you if you do.
Thank you. And I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call. I must say our speakers, of course, have been extraordinary and wonderful. And just the way they presented this information to all of you in such a sensitivity to making the complex understandable, that really is so important on these programs. And also, I want to also thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions, either online or on the telephone. You can sense from the questions that many of you are really wanting to do the very best, get the very best care, and really access as much help as possible. So I do want to, I know there are some questions left in queue. We could stay on the call all day, but that's probably, you all have other things to go on to, I know. So I'm going to give you information about how to get your questions answered. So if you should have a question that's medically focused on your care, we do recommend that you start by calling the National Cancer Institute. They have it's a toll-free number, and and actually their information specialists are always there after our calls. They know that people will have questions for them afterwards, and their number is 1-800-422-6237. 1-800-422-6237. And also, in addition to that, of course, the clinicaltrials.gov, which is the National Cancer Institute website for information about clinical trials or just really to talk to contact someone, is for those of you who wish to access the National Cancer Institute online, it's www.clinicaltrials.gov. In addition to that, if you're calling, however, to really get more information about getting some help with practical or emotional concerns or financial concerns, or joining a support group or talking to one of our social workers like Sarah, just to actually talk with someone here in terms of your particular counseling needs, or just someone to talk to about your concerns, or joining an online or telephone support group, or perhaps signing up for another program that we have coming up, or accessing some of our publications, then I would say you would call Cancer Care's number at 1-800-813-4673, 1-800-813-4673. I also should mention, although it did not come up today, but we do have a program coming up on June 8th on managing the cost of living with cancer, and that could be of interest to many of you on the call today. In addition, as we're about to conclude the program, we do not want any one of you to feel that you're alone in coping with ALL, with cancer, blood cancer, with any concerns that you may have. We want you to now know that you have access to cancer care. And, of course, we've mentioned many other organizations as well, but our staff will connect you to other organizations if you have concerns or needs. So kind of keep us in your pocket. You can call us today, you can call us next week, whenever you have a question or concern, and we will try to direct you and help to connect you. In addition, of course, is your healthcare team. That is, and our speakers have addressed this a number of times. The healthcare team is a huge number of people in your institution who actually are there also to help you as well. So, of course, you want to start with them often as well. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.